From the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., National Public Radio brings you live coverage of hearings before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Activities. Good afternoon. I'm Nina Totenberg. In the next few hours, you'll be hearing the testimony of former CIA Director Richard Helms. He'll be answering questions about the CIA's 20-year program of mail opening. The key question that the senators on this committee will be trying to get an answer to is this. Why did the CIA conduct an admittedly illegal and unfruitful mail opening project for 20 years, and for 4 years after the CIA's own Inspector General recommended that the project be terminated? Yesterday, the CIA's former Inspector General, Gordon Stewart, testified that he recommended to Director Helms in 1969 that the mail opening project be terminated. Stewart also testified that he told Helms the operation was illegal. But the illegal mail project still continued for another 4 years until 1973. In that year, the U.S. Postal Inspector, himself a former CIA official, refused to cooperate with the agency any longer. The Postal Inspector, a man named William Cotter, testified this morning along with three former Postmasters General. The three Postmasters General were J. Edward Day, appointed by President Kennedy, John Granowski, appointed by President Johnson, and Winton Blunt, appointed by President Nixon. Mr. Day testified this morning that the CIA offered to tell him top-secret information concerning the post office, but that he said he didn't want to know about it. Mr. Blunt said he was briefed by the CIA about the mail operation, but that he did not know that letters were actually open. The Rockefeller Commission concluded that Attorney General John Mitchell was also informed of the CIA's mail opening operation. But it was the Chief Postal Inspector, Cotter, the former CIA man, who finally got cold feet. He was in a dilemma. Because he had worked for the CIA and knew about the mail project, he could not deny under oath to any nosy congressional committee that the CIA was opening mail. His predecessors in his job had not known the CIA was opening mail. The CIA had deliberately kept that information from them. Moreover, Cotter felt his allegiance should now be to the Postal Service, not the CIA. So he began pressing for a specific, written presidential authority to open mail. When he didn't get it, he terminated the mail opening project. During the project's 20-year duration, the CIA screened millions of letters going to and from communist countries, mainly the Soviet Union. The CIA's own statistics show that it opened and photographed the contents of 215,000 letters during that 20-year period. At its largest mail interception point, that was the figure. We still don't have figures for the other three areas where they were also intercepting mail. The largest area was the New York City post office, and millions more letters were examined and photographed, but not opened. The material from these mail openings was shared with the FBI. In fact, the FBI provided a watch list of persons whose mail it wanted opened. VIPs were hardly exempt from the mail screening. Senator Church, the chairman of this committee, revealed last month that the CIA opened the mail of Hubert Humphrey and former President Nixon, among others. Also, Dr. Martin Luther King and Senator Kennedy. In fact, Senator Church said his mail was open. Indeed, a letter he sent to his mother-in-law from the Soviet Union when he was traveling there was opened and photographed. Now, while the senators are getting ready to start this hearing, let me review for you what the CIA knew, or rather, who the CIA briefed and how they briefed them, just briefly. When this project, the mail project, began in 1953, the Postmaster General then was Arthur Summerfield. Now, Summerfield met with CIA Director Dulles and Richard Helms, who was then a deputy, on May 19th of 1954, and he was advised of a CIA New York mail project apparently described only as photographing exteriors. In 1961, J. Edward Day, under President Kennedy, Dulles and Helms met with him. Helms has testified that he fully briefed Day on the New York project, including the mail opening aspect. Now, Day has testified that he asked not to be informed of the details and was not. So there's a conflict here, and we'll be hearing more of that from Mr. Helms today. Postmasters Granowski, Lawrence F. O'Brien, and Marvin Watson were not informed. Winton Blunt was informed. He met with Helms in 1971, as I referred to earlier. Mr. Helms is getting ready to sit down now, but we'll I'll just keep on with this chronology until he's ready to testify. Now, interestingly enough, there is a memorandum from the CIA that indicates that Mr. Helms did know that mail was open, but Mr. Helms says, according to his recollection, he did not know. The last Postmaster General, Mr. Klassen, Elmer Klassen, was not informed. Now, this morning, when these three former Postmasters General testified, two of them, Mr. Blunt and Mr. Day, gave testimony that, should we say, met with some shock from most of the senators. They seemed to think that the postmasters should have been more vigilant in finding out and stopping mail opening projects. The only guy who came out as a so-called good guy was Postmaster General Gronowski. And later, maybe I'll be able to play you a tape of an interview we did after his testimony with him. Mr. Helms is now sitting at the table, getting ready to testify. The senators aren't quite seated yet. It's very interesting to look around this room. At the beginning of these hearings, about a month ago, this room, this old Senate caucus room in the Senate office building was jammed. It no longer is jammed. Senator Church is now banging the gavel, and we'll go now to Senator Church.
Our witness this afternoon is Ambassador Helms, formerly the director of the CIA during much of the period under investigation. Mr. Helms, will you please stand and take the oath? Do you solemnly swear that all of the testimony you will give in this proceeding will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
Schwartz, would you commence with the questions, please?
Mr. Helms, as I informed you during the luncheon recess, the line of questioning I'm going to follow is to go over with you what disclosures were or were not made, first to postmaster generals, second to attorneys generals, and third to presidents, about the CIA mail opening projects. We're going to start with postmaster generals. And have you got in front of you the chart headed postmaster generals?
I have, Mr. Schwartz.
First, focusing on the not informed individuals, is it correct, to the best of your knowledge, that Messrs. Gronowski, O'Brien, Watson, and Klassen were not informed about the project?
To the best of my knowledge, sir, that is correct.
With respect to Mr. Summerfield, who was the Postmaster General from 53 till the end of the Eisenhower administration in January 61, is it correct that you and Mr. Dulles went to see him in 1954 to tell him something?
Yes, sir.
What did you tell him?
Mr. Schwartz, may I note it? I think it would save time for both of us. I will assume the dates on your paper are accurate. I mean, I don't want to have to verify them each time. I just assume we got those dates straight. But I don't want you to hold me in jeopardy if one of them is wrong.
All right. We never try and hold you in jeopardy, Mr. Helms. We just try and examine you. You went to see Mr. Summerfield, along with Mr. Dulles, and told him something, but what'd you tell him?
Well, I wrote a memorandum after Mr. Dulles and I had been to that meeting, a memorandum for the record, I guess you would call it, and I believe, as was the custom of the time, that I sent the memorandum to Mr. Dulles so that he would see what I had written about the meeting. And that is so long ago that I can only say that what is in that memorandum I would be glad to vouch for today.
All right. So you agree then that based on the memorandum, what you told Mr. Summerfield is that what the agency wanted to do was to photograph the backs and fronts of first-class mail to and from the Soviet and satellite areas?
I think that was in that general ballpark, that kind of conversation.
Well,
but the details of it, I'm sorry, I can't go any further than what the memorandum says.
Well, and the memorandum indicates that you did not tell him that mail was going to be opened. Is that right?
Yes. And may I say, sir, that...
No, is that right? I'm sorry. Did you say that I was correct when I said that?
No, what I'm trying to the only thing I'm trying to correct is that most of the talking at that meeting was done by Mr. Dulles, not by me. I was very junior at that time and very young, and Mr. Dulles was a quite articulate individual, and he carried the burden. There was no doubt about that. So when you say, did I say this, that wouldn't be a correct description. It was he that was doing this talking.
Right. But let's just make the point clear. What was told by Mr. Dulles to Mr. Summerfield was that the agency wanted to photograph the fronts and backs of envelopes, and he wasn't told the agency either had been or wanted to photograph the insides, the letters themselves.
It's my opinion today from reading these records that he was not told that the mail was being opened or would be opened.
All right. And he was never told, as far as you recall and as far as the CIA records show, between 1954 and leaving office in 61. Is that right?
I just don't know, sir.
Well, you don't recall
I haven't seen any record.
And you don't recall doing it?
I don't recall doing it. But whether Mr. Dulles did or not, you see, is something that he used to see a lot more in Mr. Summerfield than I did.
And you don't recall Mr. Dulles telling you that he did any such thing?
No, I don't have any recollection.
Right. Now, Mr. Day took over at the start of the Kennedy administration, and did you go see him?
Yes, we did. And I believe that there were three of us that the memorandum shows went to see him.
Mr. Dulles
yourself, the director, Roosevelt. And then Cornelius Roosevelt in this case, who was chief of the technical services staff, and myself.
All right. And you wrote a memorandum about that meeting indicating that you had briefed, or that the group of you had briefed Mr. Day, and that you had withheld no relevant details. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's 14 years ago, and I have to be fair enough to say that this conversation is not all that clear to me anymore. If I wrote that memorandum the next day, which I believe I did, it would have been much more accurate, and I'd like to stand on the memorandum. And I think when I said, without omitting any relevant details, that we told him the truth about the project. I think Mr. Dulles did tell him the truth about the project.
And by that, by telling the truth, you mean that in the case of Mr. Day, you told him mail was being opened?
It's my impression today. That's the way I interpret that. But I can't go any further, and I would not want to say that my memory is that infallible.
It's tab 9. All right. Now, then skipping the people who weren't told that followed in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, you did meet with Mr. Blount approximately when? Was it June of 71, which the records
Fine.
Show? That was about two and a half years after he took office. Now,
yes.
You heard his testimony this morning, did you?
Yes, I did.
Is your version of the facts the same as his?
I think basically, yes.
Well, he denied that you told him that the mail was being opened, did
well,
you?
I'm just coming to that one point because I'm trying to. He said a lot of things this morning, and I wanted to try and be as factual as possible. I no longer know exactly what documents I took along with me or what pieces of paper, let me be more precise, I took along with me when I went to brief Mr. Blount, but I thought I took along a couple of pieces of paper that would have indicated what we got out of this mail in the way of information and so forth.
And you mean actual letters, not just photographs
of
envelopes?
Well, I think that this was, I just don't recall anymore what the pieces of paper were. There may be somebody in the agency who provided them to me, you know, at the time, who might have some recollection of what they were. But I thought I had some typewritten documents that would have indicated that we had been reading correspondence between certain individuals in the United States and certain individuals in the Soviet Union.
You mean typewritten documents, but not photocopies of the opened letters?
I think they were just copies of the contents, if I recall this. Or it may just have been a memorandum in which there were a group of headings saying, we got this, we got that, we got the other thing. And since I don't remember, and since Mr. Blount's memory is different than mine, I don't want to get down to a degree of precision here that I can't support, and because he's a very honorable man, Mr. Blount, and I would just not want to be in the position of making assertions that I couldn't demonstrate that were contrary to his. But I do recall taking something down there because I was interested in persuading him that this was an interesting and worthwhile operation, even though very sensitive.
Well, is it your testimony or isn't it your testimony that you told him that the CIA was opening letters?
Well, I thought so, but maybe I wasn't specific enough about it. I don't know. I thought that this was the general purport of it, to get information out of the letters, you would have to open them.
Now, turning to attorneys general, was the first attorney general that, to the best of your knowledge, was informed about the CIA's mail opening project, Mr. Mitchell?
To the best of my knowledge, but I think it's only fair to say that I didn't know what Mr. Dulles, Mr. McCone, Admiral Rayburn might have been doing vis-a-vis various attorney generals and what they might have been talking to them about. So it is only my recollection that he was the first one that was told.
But you weren't told that anybody else?
Not that I recall.
Okay. Now, what did you tell Mr. Mitchell?
Well, my recollection is that I went to see Mitchell, and Mr. Mitchell, as I did on various occasions, because as you will have noticed in my deposition, when I went to see then President-elect Nixon in New York and was asked to stay on as Director of Central Intelligence, he had Mr. Mitchell sitting with him. And I had never met Mr. Mitchell before. And he told me on that occasion that anything that I could say to him, I could say to Mr. Mitchell, either in front of him or separately. Then when Mr. Mitchell came to Washington and became Attorney General, it was quite clear that he had a particular role for the President in sort of keeping an eye on intelligence matters and on covert action matters and just a variety of things as a sort of, I think, a watchdog for the President. So I've consulted with Mr. Mitchell on a variety of problems infecting the agency over time that I would not have gone to the normal Attorney General about. Nor would the normal Attorney General have been necessarily privy to these things. So on this occasion, as I remember the unrolling of the circumstances, Mr. Cotter and I had had a conversation about this operation, and one of the points that he made, and I thought the principal point was, that pretty soon the Post Office Department was going to be changed to the U.S. Postal Service.
He denies, incidentally, that that was his reasoning, but that's an aside.
Well, that's all right. I mean, I'm just telling my story as I recall this. And that this occurred to me as being a perfectly sensible and desirable thing to try and find out if under a new management and a quite new series of guidelines, this operation was going to be viable. So I went to the, as I recall the thing, and I'm supported by a memorandum which somebody wrote near that time, that to the Attorney General first, and I think maybe among several matters that I had to take up with him on that occasion, I told him about this operation, that what it was doing for us, that it had been producing some information on foreign connections with dissidents and terrorists, a subject in which he was intensely interested, and that we might have a problem when the U.S. Postal Service was founded. And I asked if it wouldn't be a good idea that I go and see the Postmaster General, Mr. Blunt, and talk with him about this and see how he felt about it and get some advice from him. And it was my recollection that Mr. Mitchell acquiesced in this and said, go ahead and talk to Mr. Blunt.
Now, Mr. Helms, in that answer, you used a vague term. Let's try and clarify it. You say you told him about this operation. Now, his recollection of the meeting is that you told him about a mail cover operation. Now, is it your testimony that you told him about a mail opening operation?
Well, I can only say, Mr. Schwartz, to be fair to everybody concerned, that I'm not sure that everybody in Washington was as nearly familiar about the distinction between these two things then as they are now. I mean, everybody in this room knows exactly what the two things are, but in those times, I'm not sure that necessarily the Attorney General would have known the difference. Well, I do not recall, therefore, being in a battle of terminology with him. I thought that I had gone down to explain something that was going on and the usefulness of the information we had and the fact that we would like to preserve the operation and that we were going to have a problem.
But see, that just is an unsatisfactory answer. Did you tell him that you were opening the mail or not?
Well, I'm sorry you find it unsatisfactory because I don't recall whether I said specifically we're opening X numbers of letters. But the burden of my discussion with him, I don't see how it could have left any alternative in his mind, because how do you find out what somebody is saying to another correspondent unless you've opened the letter? I mean,
well, all right. So you did tell him. All right. Are you saying?
That's my recollection.
Okay, that you told him information about what could only have come from the contents of the letters.
I thought so, sir.
All right. Now, turning then
if his perception is different, I'm sorry, and maybe legitimately so.
Right. Now, other than him, no attorneys general that you know of were talked to on this subject.
That's correct.
On the subject of presidents, first, with respect to President Eisenhower, did you speak to President Eisenhower?
No, and I would have been most unlikely
right.
that I would have.
Did Mr. Dulles ever tell you that he'd done any such thing?
I don't recall that anymore. I had, must say that I've been under the impression for a long time that I would have thought Mr. Dulles would have told President Eisenhower or possibly his brother, who was then Secretary of State, with whom he was in constant communication. But I do not recall ever seeing it in writing. Nor do I recall Mr. Dulles taking me aside and saying, I've cleared this with President Eisenhower now. But then, that's a long time ago, and it would not have loomed large in my life at that time whether he'd said it one way or the other.
President Kennedy, did you speak to President Kennedy?
I never recall discussing with President
Kennedy.
Did
either Mr. Dulles or his successor, Mr. McCone, tell you that they'd spoken to President Kennedy about the CIA's mail opening project?
I have no recollection of any such being told any such thing.
President Johnson, did you speak to President Johnson?
Well, I've often thought, as I've mused over these things in the past months, that it was an item that I mentioned to President Johnson on one occasion when I was going over some sensitive thing the agency was doing. But I have no written record of this. I have no piece of paper on which I jotted notes or anything else to support this belief of mine. So I can only just tell you that it was a belief I had. And one of the reasons that this lingers was that the postmaster generals in President Johnson's administration, except for Mr. Granowski, I knew quite well. I knew Marvin Watson well, and I knew Larry O'Brien well. And if I'd felt that there was some real need to talk to them about it, I wouldn't have hesitated.
Right. Would you look at tab 16, please, which is a memorandum for the files dated April 23rd, 1965?
Yes.
And you've had a chance to see these before. I particularly want to call your attention to paragraph 7 and ask whether that paragraph of the document does not at least strongly suggest that if you had any such conversation with President Johnson, as to which you've given your best evidence, it could not have been until after April 23rd, 65.
Well, as a matter of fact, if I discussed it with President Johnson, it would have been in the context of a particular private meeting I had to discuss some sensitive things, and it would have been a good 2 years after this.
Good 2 years after 1965.
After 1965.
So if you discussed it with President Johnson, it was at the earliest 1967, which
That's
was
right.
4 years after he took office.
And I think it was in the spring of 1967, tomorrow.
Right. Now, with respect to the final president during your activities at the CIA, did you disclose to President Nixon the CIA mail opening projects?
I never recall discussing it with President Nixon, and what President Nixon knew about it, I don't know to this day. He was vice president for 8 years and was involved in a lot of the things in President Eisenhower's administration and saw a good deal of Mr. Dulles. And what matters he was specifically briefed on by Mr. Dulles and which he was not, I don't know. But I do know that he never got into these matters when he became president. At least he never got into them with me. And as far as I was concerned, when I got around to talking to the Attorney General, Mr. Mitchell, I felt that if he felt any need to go to the President, he would have told me so right then and there and have taken care of it with the President, which he did on other matters. You will recall that when I was talking to him about the Houston plan, and he said, well, I had never heard about this till this morning and so forth, now let's wait until I have a chance to talk to the President. It's quite clear that he had that option any time he wanted to. And it was my feeling, if not my understanding, I never got this regularized with him, that when I went to him and talked about any matters affecting the agency, that if he wanted me to halt, cease, or desist, he could do so until he talked to Mr. Nixon.
So in any event, the answer is you didn't yourself speak to President Nixon?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Smothers, do you have questions?
On the subject of persons you spoke with regarding this, or the persons, to the best of your knowledge, who may have been aware of the operation, is it your belief that Mr. McCone was aware of the mail opening operation?
Well, Mr. Smothers, I've been told within the last several days that, and as a matter of fact, I don't think only I've been told, I think I heard it asserted here yesterday that, was it Mr. Osborne who was testifying or someone, that Mr. McCone says that he was not informed about the mail intercept operation. I can only say that I don't know from my own certain and specific knowledge whether he was or he wasn't, but he was director for 3 years. He was a first-class executive. I think he had a reputation for that. He certainly had access to everything that was going on inside the organization, and I just find it difficult to think that he didn't know anything about it, although there's always the plausible explanation that things he saw, he wasn't an expert in the intelligence business necessarily, he might not have known where these things came from, but that's merely a supposition on my part, which might give rise to his explanation, because at this time, as I recall it, there was a lot of going and coming in the agency about the Ken Philby case, where there was a question of it's being ascertained beyond any doubt that a member of British intelligence for many, many years, a man who had also been liaison officer here in Washington with the CIA, was a Russian agent. And some of this showed up in this mail intercept business. And I'm sure that Mr. McCone would have been briefed by Mr. Angleton, who saw him constantly on matters of one sort and another, but he may just have forgotten that this is where it came from. I don't know.
But, and you are probably as close to an expert as any on both the question of how the agency operated and, indeed, the nature of the way Mr. McCone operated. Is it your judgment that would you consider it more probable than not that McCone knew about the mail opening operation?
I think it's a little unfair to ask me that. Mr. McCone can speak for himself. One of the problems, I think, with this hearing is that so many people have died, but he certainly hasn't, and I'd rather have him speak for himself.
We'll try to do that. Let's pass on to your meeting with Mr. Day and your memorandum of 16 February 61. This memorandum was directed to Mr. Angleton, wasn't it?
Let me, I have to, could you give me the tab number so I can look at it again?
Yes, it's at tab 9.
Tab 9, is this the 16 February memorandum?
Mm-hmm.
No, I see, it's this, right. This was to the Deputy Chief CI, and I would have thought that at that time it was a man named James Hunt, but I'm not all that good on dates, Mr. Smothers, but
sure.
I thought that Mr. Angleton was chief CI in those days.
That is not critical to my inquiry.
Okay.
What was the purpose of this memorandum? Why would you have written down the results of your meeting with Mr. Day?
Because the CI staff was in charge of the, at least, the planning and the carrying out of this operation, and this was to make official the fact that we had had this meeting and that they had permission to go on with the operation. And had permission from me to go on with the operation.
So you're trying to give your managers in the agency as full amount of information as they need to go ahead and carry out this letter opening function. Is that
correct? That's the idea.
In that connection, then, it would be highly implausible, wouldn't it, that you would have communicated to them information that was in error or not true?
Well, there'd be no reason for me to do that, Mr. Smothers.
All right. Then this memorandum, and I think you heard some of the testimony this morning, also indicates that after you'd made your presentation to the Postmaster General, Mr. Day, that you were joined by the Chief Postal Inspector then, Mr. Henry Montague. Quoting from that memorandum, this gentleman, referring to Mr. Montague, confirmed that we had to say about the project and assured the Postmaster General that the matter had been handled securely, quietly, and that there had been no, quote, reverberations. Was it your impression when you wrote this memorandum then that Mr. Montague was in on it, that he knew that letters were being opened?
Sir, I can only stand on the language. It was written 14 years ago. It was written, I guess, the day after we'd had the meeting, and I...
Is that what the language says to you?
That's what it says to me.
No, I'm not. I realize the difficulty in recollection. We discussed that meeting an awful lot this morning. When you went down to see Mr. Day, you had the director, you were then the DDP, and Mr. Roosevelt. What was Mr. Roosevelt's job?
My recollection is, well, I don't even have to recall it because I have written it here. He was chief of the Technical Services Division. And the Technical Services Division was that part of the DDP office or the clandestine service, whatever you want to say, which would have carried out the actual physical opening of the letters, which, after all, I might say, is a difficult thing to do properly, so there are no complaints about it.
Did you take Mr. Roosevelt with you to ensure that this matter of the mail opening would be clearly explained to the Postmaster General?
I don't recall why Mr. Roosevelt went on this particular occasion, Mr. Summers, but I can only assume that since this was his role, that maybe we thought something might come up about it, and we wanted him there to answer any questions from a technical standpoint.
I know it's 14 years later, and I'm asking you now to look both at your memorandum and indeed the very high-powered cast of characters which went down to visit the Postmaster General. Is it at all like you, Mr. Helms, that all that took place at that meeting was merely, we have something secret that we might want to tell you, and then the Postmaster General replies, I don't think I want to hear it, and after that, the cast of characters simply got up and left?
Well, I didn't. That wasn't quite my impression of the meeting, Mr. Smothers. No, we had gone to see Mr. Day because this was a new administration. President Kennedy had just been sworn in. It was also a new party. The Republican Party had had the White House and the executive branch before, and now the Democratic Party had it. And I think Mr. Dulles felt that under the circumstances it was desirable to speak to the Postmaster General, because if it was to go forward, we needed some support for it. In other words, this was not a social visit in any sense. It was a desire to see if the operation could be continued.
You didn't go down trying to hide anything. You went down to try to convince the Postmaster General that he ought to go along with what you were doing. Is that correct?
Well, it was Mr. Dulles who did the talking on that occasion, as he did on every occasion that I went with him, and I think I know that was the purpose of our going down there, at least as my best I recall it.
Nothing further this time, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Helms, under which presidents did you serve as director of the CIA?
I was appointed, sir, by President Johnson, and I served under him and under President Nixon until early February in 1973.
And as director of the CIA, you told neither of these presidents about the mail opening program?
Well, I've explained what the situation was as far as President Johnson was concerned, as best I can pull this together. I don't recall speaking to President Nixon.
And when did you speak to Attorney General Mitchell about the mail opening program? Was that at the time that the new administration came on and you wanted to inform the Attorney General of what was going on, or
was that
a good deal later?
It was a good 2 years later.
Good 2 years later. You were aware that the mail opening program was illegal, were you not?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I am not a lawyer, and I think it would be unfortunate to take your time and the time of the committee to get into a debate on matters that are a little bit, or not only a little bit, but a great deal beyond my purview. I only want to say that we were given a charge back in the late 40s and early 50s It has not come up in any of the hearings, so at least as far as I know, the ones I've been listening to, and I'd like your forbearance for just a moment to explain something. When the remnant parts of the OSS were picked up and placed as a sort of secret service under the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, for cover purposes. After all, the Central Intelligence Agency was never designed by law to run espionage or anything of that kind. The National Security Council gave this organization, through the director of CIA, some specific jobs to do. Now, in the intelligence collection field, a more specific job was given in the area of counter-espionage or counterintelligence, if you'd like to call it that. The National Security Council Intelligence Directive gave the agency the job of analyzing, collating, and evaluating counter-espionage information. It also gave it the job of maintaining the basic files for the whole government on counter-espionage cases and individuals. And in addition, it put upon it the job of protecting the United States government, the CIA, its installations and so forth, from penetration and from any hostile intelligence services or even friendly intelligence services, as far as that's concerned. Now, this charge was a difficult one, and there are very few methods available for carrying it out and carrying it out with any reasonable chance of success. One of those things is to penetrate another fellow's intelligence service and find out who his agents are, a most difficult job. A second is to find out about foreign agents from defectors from their service. A third are intercepts, signals, telephone calls, mail, anything that one can lay one hands on. And then overseas, there are a variety of surveillance techniques which may or may not work. But those things are all that is available. Each one of them is very difficult and tricky in its own right. And I'd like to point out that we have established beyond any doubt that the number one target of the KGB and the GRU, the two Soviet intelligence services, is the Central Intelligence Agency. And so every director was very conscious of how seemingly unprotected he was against this penetration, but how important it was that he keep from having any agents get into his organization, because a great deal of governmental information can be tapped simply by having one person inside the CIA.
It comes acknowledging the difficulties that the director faces in connection with counterintelligence responsibilities. Do you believe that, that being the case, this is an agency that need not obey the law?
No, I don't think, Mr. Chairman, that you would find very many of those fine, patriotic people in the CIA that would feel that way. We were trying to get on with our job.
All
we were
right,
trying
now,
to protect our form of government without, and our way of life.
Now, we're not talking about motives. We're talking about a plan that went on for 20 years that everybody recognizes was against the law. All I'm trying to do is not talk about motives, good purposes, and patriotism. I'm trying to find out why a program like this went on for 20 years. Was against the law of the country by every indication we have, statutes, the Constitution, the decisions of the Supreme Court. And all I'm trying to find out from you is whether you believe that the CIA doesn't have to abide by these laws because of the problems that the CIA faces. Is that your position or is it not your position? You could answer that question yes or no.
Well, I think my position, I don't think things are black and white in this life, and I just simply have to say that I'm not a lawyer, and I get a bit confused when I read articles like the one that Alexander Bickel wrote in Commentary in January 1974 about the various categories of laws in this country, that one supersedes another and so forth, this all having to do with whether the anti-war movement was illegal or not. And I'm not a lawyer. I just have to say that I'd rather let it go at that.
Well, Mr. Helms, I can't let it go quite at that because I think most anybody in the country, whether he was a lawyer or not, would have a very active suspicion that opening the mail was probably against the law. You don't have to be qualified to argue the case before the Supreme Court not to have that suspicion. And the intelligent man you are, I can hardly believe that you would not have suspected that this was against the law. Did you ask your general counsel in the CIA for an opinion as to whether or not it was legal for the CIA to engage in this kind of activity?
No, I don't recall having done that. And there are plenty of memoranda, Mr. Chairman, in this record here from various people claiming that this was illegal. So, I mean, it certainly came to my attention.
Well, that's... So then it did, and it must have come to your attention that this was very questionable. In fact, the inspectors general of your own agency who looked into the program and said that, in their estimation, it produced very little worthwhile intelligence, were concerned about its illegality and at one point recommended that it be discontinued.
Well, sir, I heard the testimony yesterday about the lack of value of the operation, but I had, each time that this question came up about continuing it, I, among other things, asked for an opinion from the FBI, and I was told on each of these occasions that it was quite valuable to that organization, and I can only say that this was what motivated me to continue, because when I listened to what was said yesterday, if that had been my total appraisal of the operation, it would have been stopped a long time before.
So you were conscious of the serious question of its legality?
I was, sir.
And nevertheless, you continued to pursue the program. Because the FBI indicated that it was interested in the information you were referring to it. Is that your position?
Yes, sir. You see, the FBI has a job of an internal security,
yes,
which
is
providing a protective screen for us all, and we had to collaborate with them.
Yes. Now, knowing or suspecting its illegality, why didn't you ever raise this question with the President?
Well, it's a good question. I think that I was through the years affected by the fact that it was Mr. Dulles who started it, that he was a lawyer and had a brother who was a lawyer. I believe they were both partners in a distinguished law firm in New York. And I assumed that somehow he had made his legal peace with this, and I must say that I just never went around asking for opinions about it later on.
Well, you were aware in June of 1970 that President Nixon was concerned about the quality of intelligence he was receiving, particularly with reference to anti-war protests in this country, and that he asked the intelligence agencies, including the CIA and the FBI, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the National Security Agency, to prepare some recommendations as to how this intelligence effort could be improved. And a special report, which bears your signature and that of J. Edgar Hoover, General Bennett, and of Admiral Gaylor, the heads of the four most important intelligence and law enforcement agencies, which appears at tab 20 in the book before you.
Yes, sir.
I was prepared for this purpose and sent to the White House, where it later became the basis for what came to be known as the Houston Plan.
Yes, sir.
Now, if you'll turn to page 29, having to do with the question of mail coverage. I read this from the report, which bears your signature. It, first of all, distinguishes between routine coverage, which is legal, that being simply the photographing of the information on the face of the envelope or the taking of that information by other means, and what was called covert mail coverage, which had to do with opening the mail itself and surreptitiously screening it, and may include the opening and examination of domestic and foreign mail. And it says there, this is based on high-level cooperation of top echelon postal officials, and it is now acknowledged to be illegal.
I beg your pardon, sir. Where are you reading, Mr. Chairman? I'm sorry, I was trying to follow you. This technique is based on high-level cooperation of top echelon postal officials.
If you look on the second page, on the next page, this coverage, not having sanction of law, runs the risk of any illicit act magnified by the involvement of a government agency.
Thank you. I found it.
Then, in a statement in which the illegality is acknowledged, sent to the President, it also appears, again back on page 29, the following statement. Covert coverage, which has been defined as this illegal type of mail opening, covert coverage, the report says, has been discontinued. You read that from...
Yes, I have the place.
Now, that was the information supplied the President on which he was requested to make some decisions for, among other things, authorizing the opening of the mail. That statement, covert coverage has been discontinued, was a lie, was it not?
Well, sir, you asked me this question in executive session some months ago, and I was really agog or astounded that should have occurred to you. And I've been thinking about this and inquiring about this passage ever since. And the only explanation I have for it was that this applied entirely to the FBI, had nothing to do with the CIA, that we never advertised to this committee or told this committee that this mail operation in New York was going on, and there was no intention of attesting to a lie. This was broad mail coverage, and if I signed this thing, then maybe I didn't read it carefully enough if you want to say that I should have had them change the character of the language. But when this report was submitted to us, it came from a working group which had sat on these matters, and they were FBI activities that were being discussed, and I believe to this day that that's what was intended here. There was no intention to mislead or lie to the President.
Well, if you had been the President of the United States and had ask for recommendations coming from a report that was signed by you, the director of the CIA, by the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the two intelligence agencies, and you read in the report that opening of mail was unlawful and it had been discontinued, what would you believe?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have to concede that on the record here and without the discussion that went on at the time, it certainly looks that way, and I'm sorry if I made a mistake at that time. If I had it to do over again, I think I would have had this language very substantially changed. And may I say, Mr. Chairman, that let's not be... let me draw back, but I just simply want to say that mail coverage here is a very broad term, and what we were doing was mail coverage in a very specific area, and it is not so fantastic that it might not have occurred to me that this was going to lead to these questions today, just let me put it that way.
But the President, in this very thing that has become the Houston plan, was being asked to give his authority to do certain things that were acknowledged to be illegal. And one of the things he was asked to give his authority for was to open the mail. And yet the mail was already being opened before he was ever asked for his authority. And when he rescinded his authority 5 days later, nobody paid any attention. The mail continued to be open. How does a president exercise any control over the CIA or any of these agencies when he gets memorandum of this kind, and first agrees to authorizing mail openings and then rescinds the authority, and it doesn't matter. Either way, it continues.
Well, sir, you can make me look bad.
I'm not trying to.
But I just...
this record makes you and everyone connected with this report look bad.
I just want to ask one question. Do you know that Mr. Nixon didn't know about that CIA mail intercept operation?
If he did, I don't know why he went through the exercise of asking for a recommendation and then approving it and then rescinding it. And if he did, there's no one, including you, that have been able to tell us that he did. We had Mr. Houston here. Mr. Houston said that nobody told him, including all the meetings in which the CIA participated, that there was a mail opening plan already going on. He was the president's representative, charged with the responsibility of advising the president.
On domestic intelligence. We felt like we were in the foreign intelligence field.
Well, however you draw these lines, it comes out, the bottom line, that the president was given a document that did not tell him the truth.
Can't you ask President Nixon whether he knew or not, and then I will be guilty as charged.
We're trying very hard to bring Mr. Nixon to this committee to get his testimony, and if there's any way to do it, we will do it. Senator Mondale?
I'm ready to question that, Senator.
Senator Mondale.
All right. Mr. Helms, we have two memoranda which purport to be reports made almost contemporaneously with conversations representing the CIA and with the Postmaster Generals, both of which report that the Postmaster General was told that mail was being opened, and both have been referred to earlier. The first was February 16, 1961, prepared by yourself, in which you said...
Sir, which tab is this?
Tab 9.
Tab 9.
Right,
I've got it.
Now, this is a memorandum prepared by you on the 16th of February reporting that you and, I gather, was it Mr. Dulles?
Yes.
Had advised the then Postmaster General, Mr. Day, that you had... briefed him and, quote, withheld no relevant details. But as you know, this morning we heard from Mr. Day and he remembers nothing of that kind. How believable is this memo? What would be the circumstance that would cause you to do it? Would there be any reason to falsify in this memo? Would it be fair to say that this would be your way of trying to establish for the CIA that what had happened for future purposes and so on?
Well, yes, sir. It was. It would have been written to tell the people that were working on this matter that we had had this session and that they were permitted to go ahead. They were aware that we were going down to consult the Postmaster General, and it seemed to me quite normal to let them know the outcome of the meeting. And since it was written, I believe, the day after the meeting, I would have thought that I would have stated quite honestly what had occurred. I can think of no conceivable motive that I could have had for changing or trimming or adjusting the language.
So we often hear that, well, this is 12, 13, 14, 15 years later. I can't remember clearly, but this was the day after.
I have to stand on what the language is.
Would you not agree that this is probably a highly persuasive piece of evidence bearing on what was discussed with the Attorney General the previous day?
I thought it was. It was designed to be, sir.
And you still think it is?
As far as I know,
yeah,
I don't.
Right. Now, turning to the memorandum at tab 22, dated June 3, 1971, in this memo, and I don't know who prepared it, it's unsigned, I gather, but it does say that Mr. Helms convened a meeting to report on the recent action taken on the HT Lingual operation, which is the mail opening operation in New York, and that on 2 June 1971, which was the day previous to this memo, he had seen Postmaster General Blunt, that Blunt was entirely positive regarding the operation. He had no hang-ups. That was entirely positive regarding the operation. He opined that nothing needed to be done, rejected a momentarily held thought that we should check the legality, and rejected that. Would you similarly agree that this memorandum made the day following the briefing of Mr. Blunt is likely to be a very accurate description of what took place?
Sir, I don't know who drafted this memorandum. I want to say that at the outset. I don't know who did it. It was obviously based on a meeting that the individual attended, at which I debriefed myself about the conversation with the Postmaster General. I think that I would say that the language looks to me a little bit more enthusiastic than I would have written it myself, but then that's what often happens in memoranda of this kind taken from meetings. But I would have hoped that the basic information in it was accurate.
And you would have no reason to doubt the validity of this document or to see any reason why it would be falsified.
Well, I can't figure out why he would want to.
Because both documents were not intended for public dissemination.
They certainly were not.
They were private memoranda designed to place in the record a clear understanding of what had happened. Also, wouldn't there be a reason why you would bring along some examples of what this mail cover and opening program had disclosed? Doesn't that make sense? If you wanted to brief a new Postmaster General and you wanted to show him that things of value were being obtained, wouldn't it make sense for someone new to show him something tangible?
Yes, sir.
So that, too,
like a salesman showing him samples.
That's right. And that, too, would lead to believe the credibility of this description of what happened. Is that correct? You mentioned earlier the mood in the 40s and the early 50s that led to some of these directives to the CIA. Designed to deal with what was then called the counterintelligence needs or so on of the government as perceived by its leaders. The sense of urgency and pressure placed upon you and the other agencies to achieve this objective. Would you not say, looking back now over these last 25 years, that in effect we developed a new strategy, a new concept for American life called counterintelligence, which did tend to spill across normally restricted channels, such as legal channels, across the departmental lines, a strategy and a tendency that developed in secret, often with very closely controlled groups being familiar with what was happening, with many believing, as we've heard time and time again before this committee, that national security or some other higher purpose justified whatever it was that was thought to be necessary in the judgment of whoever was involved, opening mail, tapping lines, breaking into doctors' files, whatever. And that this counterintelligence strategy sort of grew by stealth, perhaps under direct orders of the president or people under the president, but it was something that grew over the years. But that it was largely unrecognized by the law, unknown outside of these agencies, and the sort of thing that was very difficult to try to get approval for. So it just operated and grew in this strange extra-legal way into what has now been spread out on the record before this committee over the last several weeks. Would that be accurate?
I think that is a rather good description, sir. May I, could I add a couple of points to it, with your permission? One, the concept of a secret service was brand new to this country in World War II, and may I say, alien to it in many respects. This country doesn't like secrecy, by and large. And when you consider that a new concept was taken and put into the government, sort of almost like a foreign body, and then had to find its way in its own level and its method of operating and all the rest of it, and having brought with it a wartime concept of how you do these things, during the war it was to kill Germans and to do the much damage to the Germans as possible, right. And it wasn't very long after President Truman got in that we discovered that there was no way of getting along with the Russians. So the next thing was, how do you not only settle this organization which had been taken from the OSS into the government, but there was another interesting problem, and that is that there were a lot of communist and Russian sympathizers in the OSS as soon as we started working against the Russians that had to be taken care of. Right. And if you have had some experience in this yourself, you know that that's a rather delicate and difficult thing to do. And it was in those days that Mr. Hoover was very disapproving of some of the people in the CIA, and we had that problem to contend with.
So there were many difficulties in trying to bring before the appropriate authorities, including the Congress, approval and guidelines and standards that you could be governed by in your activities. And would you say that as a result of this shadowy, murky, and sometimes dirty business that was undertaken, that you were substantially handicapped by the failure to have such standards? And that perhaps maybe the most important thing that this committee can do before we're done is to try to put this genie back in the bottle, define the law precisely and clearly, and get away from any future suggestions that people can, in any level of government, can act beyond the law for any reason whatsoever. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I think that it's a most praiseworthy aim, and exactly how you put this all together, I think, is going to be a lot more difficult than it seems on the surface.
But now that we know, can there be any turning back? Must we not absolutely pin this down so we know exactly what's going on?
Oh, I don't think there is any turning back. I agree with you.
Thank you, Mr.